Black hole staring at the total eclipse of the sun. In honor of the eclipse, what is your favorite pop culture involving an eclipse not of the heart?
I'm Matt Patches, and I watched a wonderful film on the day of the eclipse that I'm now going to name as my favorite film involving an eclipse. That would be Georges Méliès' The Eclipse or The Courtship of the Sun and Moon, where the sun and moon fuck.
Ooh. I'm David the Seven, and I'm going with Pitch Black, which might end up being peak Vin Diesel, even though it is basically Aliens.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm going to go with that episode of Mad Men where Don is talking to someone during the eclipse who says that he stares at the sun every day. And Don says, "You stare at the sun every day," in that Don way. And it's biting.
I thought you were going to pick Little Shop of Horrors.
You don't know me.
I thought you were going to sing the entire Little Shop of Horrors show.
Little Shop of Horrors.
Little Shop of Terrors. Watch him drop. Little Shop of Horrors. Shang-a-lang.
Oh, wait, we're really going to do the whole show? Great.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine, too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 178. Our numbers get confusing because we had a quarter full last week, but you got to have only one for each number. This is number 178 for Tuesday, August 22nd. And on this day in 1921, J. Edgar Hoover became the director of the FBI.
And gave Leonardo DiCaprio his greatest role. J. Edgar, the unforgettable film.
Unforgettable.
Can't forget it.
I might have forgotten it, most of it.
Anyway, we
had a quarter coil. It's a big thing for us. We aired some of our hearts. I'm hoping it earned us some reviews, David.
It did indeed, Dave. It earned us three reviews, it seems. Maybe four. I mean, this fourth one, I think, some of these reviews may have actually come in before the quarter quell. We did not read any reviews during our quarter quell episode, so some of them may have been a little bit earlier. But let's run through them real quick. Let's start with Fu Mike Chu, who says, "One star, annoying start. That clown horn at the start of each episode is annoying AF. Seems like it's meant to be." I
think we may have read this one already.
We have?
Now we're self-flagellating by reading it again.
Well, there's nothing I can do like a good self-flagellation, but Fu Mike Chu, if I didn't say it the last time, I prefer to read this review as "seems like it's meant to be," as though it's meant to be that you are going to listen to our podcast. So I'm going to say this review was not helpful, but that's only because it wasn't. Cinnamon Pod.
We did that one already, too.
I'm being told we already did. What about Popcorn Kernel Blimp? I would never forget a name like that.
No.
Popcorn Kernel Blimp says, "I love you all, but not as much as I love Fassbender. This is one of my favorite film and pop culture podcasts. The hosts are mostly good. The updates arrive on a mostly reliable schedule. And the rotating cast of guests are mostly great. Hoffman's shrill energy is a welcome jolt every now and then. Listen to this podcast. Nota bene. If David reads this in his best Fassbender using the Walter Frank voice, I will surrender that fifth star."
Whoa.
You know what?
Why didn't we read that part first?
I don't read any of these advances. It's part of my policy.
That's right.
And I'm not your monkey. I'm not your plaything.
Do you do a Walter Frank impression? I'm not recalling that in
not,
your
not that
repertoire.
I'm aware of.
Can you attempt that, at least with the first sentence of this review, again?
No.
For I'm us. For, come on.
It's worth
will,
a whole star.
The next quarter quell, star. Which we will
pretend I'm
Waylon. Entirely as impressions. But
pretend I'm an engineer.
I'm going to say this review was helpful. I wish I could also... I actually can say it's helpful and report a concern. The concern being that this person wants us to do interviews or rather podcasts in different voices, but I won't. I'm just going to say it was helpful. Finally, FJA243 says, enjoyable company for your workday. 5 stars. I finally got around to review this podcast, so here goes my attempt at this type of review. Dave Seven obviously is the Chewbacca of the group. Indispensable and endearing. Ehrlich is easy. Everyone needs an antagonist. Obviously, he's the 3CPO of the crew. It's C-3PO, right? I'm not crazy.
It's a typo.
It is
C-3PO.
I'm just making sure. I'm not, you know, throwing FJA
2.3. That's very C-3PO of you. Good job.
Yes, David, yes. Always coming after people with their Star Wars trivia.
This is true. I'm known for that.
Big fan.
K. Rich is the hero upon which everyone organizes. So you're the Luke. Now to the most conflicting person.
He wishes
I'd say Han, but not gonna happen. He is far too needy for that. Wow. I started listening because he was promoting this podcast on another show. Patches is the Princess Leia, the unsung driving force, the self-appointed leader of the group. I do hate some of your opinions, Patches, but I started listening because of you. Parentheses, Joanna is the R2-D2 everyone likes. Really enjoy all of you. This review was very helpful to me because it gave me a broader understanding of the Star Wars universe and my and all of our roles in that universe. So
I'm also wearing my Princess Leia curls tonight, so
that's especially quite, appropriate. Quite a visual. Thank you for that. Yeah. Let's onwards.
I also want to end by saying that although everybody sort of likes R2-D2, I do not like R2-D2, and that's a conversation.
Well, you don't like R2-D2 because he's a rule breaker. Sorry, I'm opening the can of worms here, but is that the case?
I mean, we have talked about why I don't like R2-D2 on a Fighting in the War Room Star Wars special. You can find it at fightinginthewarroom.com. And I think he's a little withholding considering he knows the entire story of the saga and still lets certain things happen. But
right.
You know,
he can fly, but he chooses not to in the
He chooses
movies.
Not to for all the latter movies. Anyway, let's get on to a podcast that is not about R2-D2. It's the dream.
This weekend, Steven Soderbergh came out of retirement. He made a movie. And he put it in theaters himself with a very unique financial model that we'll maybe get into. But his, Soderbergh has always been a rebel when it comes to how we make movies and how we put movies in front of people and the standards for making film and being a big name director. And this weekend he decided to defy expectations by kind of raising money and putting self-distributing, I believe, on some level, maybe with the help of Bleecker Street and his own company Fingerprint Releasing. He put out Logan Lucky, a very funny heist comedy starring Channing Tatum, Adam Driver, Riley Keough, Daniel Craig, bunch of other famous faces, and it bombed. The movie bombed. I was actually pretty shocked. I thought this movie would maybe be a sleeper hit, kind of creep into theaters. Logan Lucky concerns a couple West Virginian guys. Channing Tatum loses his job. He's, I believe he's working on filling in sinkholes at a NASCAR speedway when he gets kicked out because he has an injury. Yeah, we've all been there. We can really relate to that. But he, you know, he wants his vengeance. He wants his money. He wants to take care of his kid. His wife, played by Katie Holmes, is ready to move away with her rich car dealing husband and take his kid away. He needs to make some money to keep his life together. He is going to pull a heist with his one-armed brother, Adam Driver. And it's got all the trimmings. It's basically an Ocean's 11 movie with, you know, a bunch of guys from West Virginia using what they've got. You have the like slick Danny Ocean types, and then you have these guys who use gummy worms and, you know, cleaning detergent to make bombs and, you know their way around NASCAR. And that's, they're going to be their target. It's another walk of life, but kind of the same process.
There's no shame in referring to it succinctly as Ocean's 7-Eleven, which was the hacky punchline before the movie came out, and Soderbergh was way ahead of us there. He explicitly references that, I mean, uses that phrase in the movie. I think it's like a local news anchor who says it, which is a little bit of a jab. Like, look, well,
the press,
hack.
The press calls them, what, the hillbilly something. The hillbilly heist, maybe. I don't know. But, I mean, everyone underestimates them because they're blue-collar guys from West Virginia, and no one can even suspect that they would, on the biggest race, the Coca-Cola 600 on Memorial Day weekend, infiltrate the NASCAR Speedway and break into the vault and steal millions and millions of dollars in cash. Unfortunately, Logan Lucky could not steal millions and millions of dollars of American money this weekend. What happened? It's a big question. It's interesting how they approached making this movie. I don't know if you guys saw Channing Tatum was working his ass off trying to promote this thing outside the usual means, just like the way that they distributed it. Instead of doing like New York and California junkets, he drove across the country trying to put this movie in front of, you know, the rest of the country, middle America, you know, the types of people who might not get a movie like Ocean's 11 made about people like them.
And the real tragedy of this movie is that it sort of represented a great hope for a new model of indie filmmaking, in much the same way as Radiohead putting out In Rainbows that a pay what you will scheme did, in that even if this been successful, and it's still, I mean, the movie grossed about half as much as Soderbergh wanted it to in its opening weekend, but it may be too soon to deem the model an outright failure. But what I mean by that Radiohead comparison is that it's a great, potentially great move for Steven Soderbergh. It doesn't necessarily mean that it works for any sort of upstart indie filmmaker. You really need the cachet and star power that someone like Steven Soderbergh brings to it. But what the long and short of what made this gambit so interesting is that they essentially cut the studio machinery out of the equation. They sold the streaming rights of the film for roughly somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 million all told to help cover the marketing. I mean, that's the money that they put in the marketing, or the money they would. And the idea was, as Patches said, that they weren't just going to go to the obvious spots, billboards in Times Square and out in LA and whatnot. They would actually target the people that they believed to be the demographic for this movie. That's why Channing Tatum was reenacting scenes from Magic Mike XXL on unsuspecting convenience store workers in wherever it was in West Virginia. What he did is he gave Bleecker Street, the small indie upstart, $1 million to essentially organize this marketing campaign that he was going to supervise 100%. There was going to be absolutely nothing, no part about it that he did not personally approve of, which is a huge change of pace from the way that studios usually do this. As you could tell from the nature of the marketing materials. And the idea was that when it came time to splitting up the profits, everyone would be a lot closer to the money. And Bleecker Street, when the movie turned a profit, would get a substantial portion, or not a substantial portion actually, but a slice of the ticket sales. And then a slice of ticket sales would go to all of the cast and even the crew and Soderbergh himself, who the cast was all working for next to nothing relative to the usual rates. I mean, you have somebody like Daniel Craig, who's making untold tens of millions of dollars, especially with his profit participation on James Bond, who's obviously taking a huge pay cut here. But even so, had this film been like an Ocean-sized hit, he would have cleared a hefty, hefty amount of money. And so on.
But this didn't happen. This did not. This movie didn't make a ton of money. So these, you know, dreams will not come true, especially for Bleecker Street and Soderbergh and those guys, right? I mean, this is not a success.
It did not come through, and it's very disappointing to me because I don't understand why people didn't see this movie. I really don't. I mean, I think that had this movie come out 15 or 20 years ago, it would have been a really... It wouldn't have had to go through all these crazy machinations because it would have been a pretty safe bet. And it would have done very well. And
well, is that the flaw of Soderbergh? You know, Soderbergh always talks about how we spend too much money on promotion. But maybe what Logan Lucky evidences is that you need the promotion to convince people. First off, Logan Lucky is a bad title for a movie that you want people to actually see. personally.
Especially the same year that there was another movie called Logan that had nothing to do
right.
with it.
I already saw Logan. I don't need to see the other Logan movies. Actually, there's another, I believe there's another movie called Logan coming out. Or Lucky. No, there's a Lucky movie coming out in a few weeks. But from the posters and the trailers and the title itself, I feel like there's a huge kind of like artistic barrier between this. It could have sold out a little more to showcase how fun it is. And I think that's what's really surprising, that I thought this was almost up there with Ocean's 11 and just how like primal fun it is. Every step of the way, I was enjoying watching these characters solve a problem. You know, Soderbergh has the gift of making insert shots really exciting, and the operations of a heist. I think that's what he seems obsessed with, how things work and deconstructing that, and then tying character quirks into all these problem solving. And it really works for me, just even just seeing it in a new setting. You know, we got three Ocean's movies. Some of them are good. David, you love Ocean's 12. That's fine. Maybe one day they'll find a cure for you. But like, those are totally fun movies. And this is right up there, I think, with Ocean's 11 for me. And just in terms of like seeing a new world and seeing how different types of people solve problems, especially in this day and age where we're all warring over territory and butting heads and feeling like each state in this country is its own mini country that needs to be protected. You know, we're all the same and everyone has their own ways of solving problems. And I found it really relatable on a character level and really exciting every step of the way. I don't know why this movie didn't appeal to people. Why didn't it seem to be so fun?
I really don't know, especially because I think that the advertising for the movie, as much as I like the film just fine, I mean, I had a lot of fun with it. I suspect that I'll rewatch it ad nauseum when it's on TV, but the trailers, the ad campaign was so much more lively and upbeat than the movie is itself. I mean, the movie is a lot more of the closer, at least, to sort of the sterile, subdued feeling of digital era Soderbergh. So I really, really don't know. And it worries me. This was one of those few misses of the summer where that really put me in that headspace, similar to what we talked about in the Cortic Well last week, of like wanting every movie to do well now and not really being able to wrap my head around why this one did not.
It might have just been a bad summer to not be automatically attached to studio movies as a trailer, because I didn't see a trailer for Logan Lucky out here. And like, granted, I only saw like maybe two indies in the past month, but you'd think that would have come up at some point, and it just didn't. So like, I was targeting advertising's good, but there is something to be said for carpet bombing something with whatever additional things that you get on top of the movie that draws people into a movie, like Steven Soderbergh's back. Like, do we ever figure out who wrote it, or is who wrote it still like a mystery?
It's written by Rebecca Blunt.
Right, who most likely doesn't exist or is a friend of a friend who doesn't want to be credited or so on. I mean, maybe it was written between Soderbergh and his wife Jules Asner. Soderbergh has adopted pseudonyms of female nature before, his mother's.
See, like, even that's an interesting narrative for somebody that maybe wouldn't want to see a NASCAR movie, but understands this is a Steven Soderbergh movie with like a weird hook in it. So, I mean, maybe it is what Patches was saying. Maybe we do, like, if there's one thing the studio system occasionally does right, maybe it's just getting stuff out in front of people regardless of quality. Maybe that's where we're left at.
I mean, this is total speculation, like armchair psychology, but you know, the Ocean's movies were such big money-making hits, and that there's an aspirational aspect to that, right? You want to see these guys in super nice suits, you know, heist in a fancy casino, and here it's just it looks like your backyard. It looks like where you'd go for a weekend out. You'd go to a NASCAR race. Like, who wants to see just another day in the life of these guys, struggling guys?
That makes, I think, assumptions about audience members that aren't
definitely
willing to leap to. But maybe, I guess.
I just, it's funny because we're talking about like how this movie is getting promoted. How do people detect this movie? But Daniel Craig was out there talking about being Bond again to make sure people were watching segments of Colbert where he's playing clips of this hysterical performance. I absolutely love Daniel Craig in this movie doing this twang, this southern high-pitched particular, the way he eats hard-boiled eggs in this movie makes me laugh. Like, every little quirk that this guy has on his sleeve, it's just a performance we never see, not a hint of in Bond, really. And he's just going for broke. But that should be enough, right? Like, he's one of the bigger stars in the world because of Bond. Why don't you want to see someone change it up? And maybe that's the syndrome here. People don't like to see the formula change. You can't say from the director of Ocean's 11 and then having Channing Tatum drive a pickup truck and like slowly walking around the NASCAR track. It's like kind of boring. I don't know. It's a mystery.
Well, maybe they could still rescue Logan Lucky by giving it legs if what we've talked about makes you at all curious. Don't wait for it to be streaming. They've already sold those rights. Go now. Logan Lucky in theaters.
I ain't got time for these niggas. Better throw a watch at the bar. I have my boys in this bitch looking like a seminar. Who the fuck you talking to, motherfucker boy? I ain't got time for these bitches. Better throw a clock at these hoes. Had these hoes in this bitch looking for a water hose. Who the fuck you talking to, motherfucker boy? I ain't got time. Boy, I need a Kleenex. How I got this far, boy, I can't believe it. That I got
okay, Katie,
this far,
so you are now on the podcast because you just got here. You took a long drive, I believe, to go see The Eclipse. Now, it's not a movie, but we still want to talk about it because
it was cinema.
It's a once-in-a-lifetime.
It was cinema in the sky.
Yes, it's God's gift beyond
Soul Surfer. Painting dreams with light. That's what cinema is, according to old Academy Awards ceremonies.
So Katie is dialing in to the broadcast to tell us about watching The Eclipse, because you were actually in the dark zone, the phantom
zone. The path of totality.
Yeah, there's a lot of really good slang that goes along with Eclipse. Path of totality is a solid one. And yeah, my parents have a house on a lake in South Carolina that was right in the middle of the path, so it's like a 70-mile wide path that would actually see the full eclipse. And if you're like the closer you are to the center, the longer you get to see it. So we were kind of in a good spot for it. So, and we drove 5 hours each way to see it.
Wow!
And just got back.
Wow! So what did you prepped with glasses? You got real glasses.
Yes,
I hope.
Had the glasses. My mom ordered them, and we checked that they were not fake and they would not burn out our eyes. And we, you know, had looked up like the time that everything was going to happen and went out on a boat, and my parents' friends had another boat, and we tied up together kind of in this corner of the lake where there were like a dozen other boats probably. It was crowded more than usual, but like not insane. I think if you were in a city or in a lot of other places, it would have been nuts. Apparently, there's a lot of crazy Instagram videos from Charleston Harbor. I'm just now catching up on the internet.
Well, I feel like we should pit our experience against yours, because I guess, I mean, being in New York, we were not in the zone, in the correct place to see it, but we still got to see a little something. I went on top of my building at work and got to see a partial eclipse. It didn't really get that dark out in New York. So
I would
just
not imagine.
Standing.
And so what you saw, basically, you're looking through glasses and you saw like an orange ball that kind of became like more and more like a crescent moon and then got bigger again?
I think it was just mostly crescent the whole time. I didn't stick around for the whole thing.
Oh, okay.
It was like standing outside for 20 minutes and be like, oh, there it is. And then I went back to work.
I had a wonderful eclipse. I thought it would be fun to go for a little jog when right before the eclipse was supposed to start, because I figured that it would be a little bit more shade. It would be a little bit cooler. And so I ran out with my eclipse glasses on my head. And as I was running home, I ran by my neighbor, who is Jason Sudeikis, who I
really
do not know, and he does not know me, but he does live next to me, with Olivia Wilde. And he was on the lawn with some friends, and they had like this telescope contraption. And so I just like stood outside and took off put on my glasses. And it turned out that I was the only one who had a pair of glasses. So they became even as sweaty as they were with me having just run this like communal pair of glasses, and everyone was trying to put them over their cameras and their phones. And there was like there was like 5 or 6 people there that stood around for about 20 minutes, not all of whom knew each other. It wasn't just like me and them. They were like another group of people. And you could tell that like there was like a really casual, fun vibe of like we're all like laughing and joking, and there's no like stranger danger feeling. You don't get that a lot in New York. It's always pronounced when you do. And I mean, the last time I felt like I had seen something with that particular vibe was the morning after Hurricane Sandy, when there was no cell phone service or electricity or Wi-Fi. We were all just sort of like walking north towards information, and it was a really, really fun vibe.
That's lovely.
Yeah, it was a really good time. I mean, I just liked. I'm not a talk to your neighbors kind of person. I wish I were sometimes. It's just like it's, I wasn't built that way, and so I'm always caught by moments where I go into that mood with like no apprehension whatsoever, it was lovely. And it wasn't very dark, but the kind of light that it cast over the city for that entire like 20 minutes in either direction was like periwinkle, like Instagram filter sort of light. Was really, really neat.
Was it noticeably cooler?
It was noticeably, but not, that doesn't mean significantly. It was like a few degrees.
I felt kind of woozy after.
I had my first nosebleed in 20 years.
Really? I feel like there might be something up with that.
It's all the staring at the sun. Even if like, you're wearing the glasses, something about it like makes you feel like your head spinning.
Yeah. It's not good to look at the sun, turns out. So wait, Katie, you were in the thick of it. So now tell us about your experience. How many Cthulhus did you see erupting from the black orb?
Well, I need to look up the myth of the lizard man of Bishopville, South Carolina, because the story is he was going to come back when the eclipse started. I mean, so the light that David's talking about, like, I think that was probably much more extreme where I was, and then kind of like slowly dawns on you that it feels like it's dusk, even though it's not. And even though, you know, you get to like the tiniest sliver of the sun, you're looking through your glasses, and it still feels like daylight, which is really bizarre to realize how powerful the sun is. And so it gets dimmer and dimmer, and then the crickets start going, and then all of a sudden, like, you kind of watch the, like, the diamond ring effect they talk about, where you see the tiniest little bit of sun, and then it just slips behind, and the sun turns into this black disc, and it has been the sun, because without your glasses, it just looks like the sun, and then all of a sudden, it is black and has this glowing ring around it, and it is really surreal, and I think it's something, like, it's like maybe hearing about other people's dreams. Like, if you haven't seen it, it's kind of boring to hear someone describe it, but it is the thing that I drove 5 hours each way for, and absolutely would tell anybody to do. It's just so different from what it's like to see the moon moving across the sun through your eclipse glasses and feel a little bit of difference in the air is really interesting, but that experience of totality is so extreme, and you can only get it by being in that 70 mile wide band. And I, you know, there's another eclipse in 7 years that's going to go through where my brother lives, and I don't know, I'm thinking about going. Why not see it again?
It's coming to New York.
Well, it's upstate New York, I think.
Oh.
Not New York City.
It's on tour.
If you Google it, like Eclipse 2024, you can see the map. You know, this is what I do now. I look up.
You're going to be an eclipse chaser. Some people have fish, and you have eclipses.
You can come stay with me in 2043.
I understand that this technology, this sort of astrological would be the wrong term. I'm not even qualified to use basic science terms.
Astronomical?
But astronomical technology. Has been around for millennia, and the Mayans and Aztecs and whatnot all use this shit, but that does not stop me from being very impressed by that New York Times article that was going around from 85 years ago, where the headline in the New York Times was the next nationwide eclipse is going to be on August 21st, 2017. And I don't know. Yeah. It's pretty crazy to me.
Well, it's when you're sitting there and you're like watching the eclipse start to happen, and it's like the most basic thing that you would know about if you've ever looked at the way that the sun and the moon and the earth work. You're like, of course this happens, but it feels really primally weird to be standing there on earth and watching something that you are familiar with blocked out, and just kind of this argument between the rational part of your brain and the animal brain that is like the crickets that are all of a sudden chirping and thinking like, oh my God, what is happening? I mean, I was standing up on this boat holding my baby watching it happen. Like, my knees started to wobble.
You could see it moving. Could you see, because of the shadow, if you watch it long enough, can you really see it kind of drifting across, or would you have
a little bit? Yeah, I could kind of tell when it was almost over, and like, you know, it's only 2.5 minutes, so you kind of have a sense that the clock is ticking anyway, but you see just like the thickness of the light on one side get a little bit thicker, and then, you know, the minute that it pops back out, you have to put your glasses back on, so you kind of are waiting for the moment that you are going to burn out your eyes. But I mean, you watch the the sun itself, but also, like, you know, there's a 360-degree sunset, so on all sides of you, and we're out on a lake, so you have these views of these clouds hovering and, you know, watching other people and watching the sky, and there are, you can see Mars and Venus. There's a lot to see, even though the black sun itself is probably...
It has a melancholia vibe, you know.
Yeah, oh, yeah. There definitely was a sense, like, right before it started where I just kind of, like, you get kind of anxious. Like, you kind of feel all of these things that are not supposed to be happening, and it's like, well... If I guess the world could end, like, it seems it's possible.
If we're lucky.
And you're going to be pursuing that feeling every 7 years or something for the rest of
life. Well, it was also funny to be there with Charlie, who's a year old, and, you know, I tried to get him to look at the total eclipse, and he wasn't interested and didn't get it at all. So he was there but doesn't know it, so maybe he'll be inspired to chase eclipses and see what he missed out on when he was a baby.
Mm. Maybe. Let's see what happens when he figures out the concept of zero, and we'll move from there.
Whoa.
Dave, what did you see?
Oh, I think we got like 96 blockage from where we were. So, yeah, cool light, cool shadows, absolutely all stop of nature sounds, which I found interesting. We did not have crickets, but all the birds shut up.
That's really
and then,
interesting.
Yeah, the time on either side where it was like slowly fading through different types of light, I spent a lot of time on my balcony just looking at things.
Yeah.
Because I tend to see the world through Photoshop filters. So just watching how the greens changed, I was like, holy shit, this probably really freaked out Ancient Man. Oof. It would freak me out if I didn't know there was science behind it.
I enjoyed the period where it became tolerable to sit in the sun because it had just gotten weak to the point that it wasn't burning you. Because, you know, we're on a boat where, like, the surfaces are so hot that if you touch them, it burns your hand. So I, like, jumped back in the water and didn't have my sunglasses on. And it was a nice feeling. It's just weird. It's weird for the sun to get weaker. You don't think that that is the thing that's going to happen while you're sitting in a place.
Yeah. And when it does actually happen, then there will be nothing several minutes later.
Whoa. Well, I mean, it also happens like when it's winter, but it's just a very gradual process.
No, Katie, apocalypse or this one time.
Don't you have eight minutes after it goes out to like enjoy life? Don't you get 8 minutes of sunlight?
Something like that.
I'll cling to that in the end.
It's okay. We're going to live to see that. So don't worry.
Oh, boy.
Right?
I thought the eclipse was very inspiring and life-affirming, so the fact that you want to turn it into an apocalyptic event is, I guess, predictable. But
the eclipse. See it.
See it.
Jason Sudeikis loved it, too.
He really did. He really did. Very nice guy, I have to say.
That is the New Yorkiest eclipse story. It's like, I just happened to share eclipse glasses with Jason Sudeikis.
Dun 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 dun. That's how we start. I don't know where we go from there.
I mean, I'm happy to start this. So
go do it.
So you may or may not know this, but a little movie by James Cameron, who only makes very little movies, is coming back into theaters. I don't know how wide the release is going to be, but it'll at least be in some theaters. It is a spiffed up 3D version of Terminator 2: Judgment Day. Which is, he's putting back in theaters in much the same way as he did Titanic a few years back when there was that 3D re-release. But what's different, at least for me, about Titanic and Terminator 2 Judgment Day is that I, prior to going to see this at a screening last week, had never actually sat down and watched Terminator 2, Judgment Day.
What?
All the way through.
Wait.
I didn't realize that.
That's the premise of this segment, is that you saw Terminator 2 for the first time. You saw it in 3D.
I don't know if I'm necessarily making it the premise of the segment, but it's definitely my way into it.
But David,
well,
if
that statement's true, it is the premise of this segment.
If you hadn't seen Terminator 2, how did you understand what was happening at Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines, or Terminator Salvation, or Terminator Genesis?
I grew up on cable TV, so I have seen large chunks of this movie many, many times, but never contiguously.
It was on TNT.
Terminator 1 is one of like the first movies I ever saw. It scarred me for a long time. So I definitely saw that one. But yeah,
that's what's so interesting about these two movies. Terminator is like, I rewatched that movie a few weeks ago. That is a scary movie.
Yeah, Terminator 1 is fucking terrifying. Yeah. Terminator 2 is obviously a lot less so. You know, because you have benevolent Arnie. But, you know, the really sort of obvious way of approaching this would be to think about the film's, well, not only just how well the film is held up or not held up, but also its relevance. I mean, in really broad strokes, you're watching a movie about a sociopathic, homicidal white police officer who is rolling over everyone who gets in his way and can. And then on the other hand, in a more just to really tap into, I don't know, the well, actually, I mean, both of them are equal in the political landscape right now. But just the nuclear horror of it all is something that has only recently resurfaced, whereas some of the cop imagery and whatnot, I think, has been potent for a long time. But the nuclear imagery just came back. And that sequence, Sarah Connor's dream sequence in 3D or
where
not.
Where her skin melts off her face.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot. It's really terrifying. I think, newly terrifying all over again.
It's interesting
but I have
that you,
to say,
you had like a cop read on it. I don't really think, rewatching it, that
I'm
did
not
dawn on me.
Stressing that to a breaking point because I think, I don't know, that's think piece fodder, but...
yeah, this is a think piece podcast at a time.
James Cameron was very, and you can see this in the film that he helped make with Catherine Bigelow, Strange Days. But, this movie was just before the time of the L.A. riots and Rodney King. That's when it was in production. It came out in 1991. It was made in 1990. I think that James Cameron was very much in touch with the image of the, chisel-jawed male cop as this powerful figure who could be...
Well, I will say the LAPD does gun down the only black character in the movie.
Yeah, so I don't believe that is accidental, and I don't think that it would be wrong to read into it in its current context. I think its current context is a lot like the context that it was when it was made. Like, I joked when I saw the movie, it's amazing how much the movies have changed since 1991, and yet Donald Trump is still the country's loudest racist. So the more things change, the more they stay the same. But I will say... And this, to me, is a little sacrilegious because I, within reason, kind of revere James Cameron. I mean, I don't love everything about all of his movies, but I love the scale of them. I love the tactile feeling of them. I love his dumbass stories and how intelligently he tells them. And I really don't think this holds a candle to the excitement of True Lies or the emotional force of the Abyss or the horror of the Terminator or the majesty of Titanic or just the sheer immersiveness of Avatar. I think this is one of his lesser films, but I don't want to downplay how much it really pushed the whole idea of blockbuster filmmaking forward. I think that it was definitely a landmark.
Well, what's so interesting about that, like, we always talk about Terminator 2 being this kind of pinnacle of blockbuster filmmaking, being really influential. I was thinking as watching it today that I never hear people talk about it. Like, you hear a lot of people talk about, oh, Star Wars had such a big impact. Every time they make a Marvel movie, someone wants to, like, make Star Wars, or they want to make an action movie out of a different genre. It's like, all the President's Men, but with action. They never talk about, like, you never hear people talk about Terminator 2 because you look at it and you're like, this movie doesn't get made today. No one is emulating Terminator 2 in the movies
today. Wait. They are, but like the Spielberg reactionists, they've gone too far. Like, Terminator 2 is Michael Bay is trying to do that all the time, from the way it structures its action sequences, where there are jokes in between action beats. Like, the T-1000 will see a mannequin that, like, looks like himself, or a biker will, like, react to Arnold Schwarzenegger's penis, like, right after he, commits some horrible violence on somebody. So, like, the idea that, like, the gigantic truck going into the irrigation thing, the scale of those ideas, I think, are what's being emulated in modern-day action cinema. It's just Terminator 2 has such a restraint because it's transforming the formula of Terminator 1 from a sci-fi horror film to an action
I don't know.
Action
I credit
would be.
Jerry Bruckheimer with where Bay went and, like, the Con Airs and... everything that was happening in the 90s, Top Gun, Top Gun sprouted, and there was James Cameron doing his thing, and then the Top Gun, Bruckheimer, and where Bay went and went spun out of control. I don't know if I see that as an extension of, like, what Terminator 2.
Well, you think that Top Gun looks more like a Michael Bay movie than Terminator 2 does?
or do I think Top Gun looks more like a Michael Bay?
I mean, I think that, you know, he definitely had those as interests, as influences, but yeah. In terms of, like, visually, I could see Terminator 2 ending up as, like, a Michael Bay visual style. I'm not sure if Top Gun, like, almost has too much establishing to
about
it. I mean,
Michael Bay definitely borrowed a lot from this before he established his own visual style. I mean, there are traces of it in Bad Boys, and he sort of grew from there, but, you know, it is the movie that James Cameron made right after The Abyss. I mean, it reeks of James Cameron. He is a full-fledged auteuristic force at this point. I just think that the story is thin. He doesn't really wrestle with a lot of the implications in the way that, like, the retcon of Terminator 3 was almost necessary because of how half-assed a job they do with the quantum mechanics of this one. There's just a lot of going to this location and going to that location and then going to the next one. I mean, there are iconic beats and they earn their power, but I really just think that this...
I'm kind of with you, actually.
Yeah, it doesn't really hold up in that sense, but I think that the scale that he was operating on, the kind of visuals he was going for, do his need for progress. I mean, it's all there. I just think as a story, it's not really in service of anything. And I think that it doesn't even make any sense in the internal logic of this franchise, the whole idea of being able to change the future like that. And I think that had I seen this when it came out in 1991, I would have been really frustrated and been frustrated until the otherwise negligible Terminator 3.
Wait, you would have been frustrated because there's not enough explanation or there's not enough, like, reckoning with the logic of it?
There's not enough reckoning with much of anything. I mean, it's a very...
But that's why it's so, like, the fun of this movie, rewatching it, was he tells us just enough. Like, there's a scene where...
But he doesn't. I love these spare Spartan sort of action movies where they really just get you the bare bones of what you need to know. I don't actually think that... I'm not saying it's, like, a volume issue where we don't get just enough raw data, but maybe the data that we do get is not the data that we need.
No, but, like, the exposition blasts are hilarious because Schwarzenegger as Model 101 or whatever, he walks in and John Connor's like, oh, what does this new robot do? And he's describing the rules of what the, like, liquid alloy can do. It can't be a gun. It has too many parts. It can be a sword hand. It's like, what are you talking about? Okay, let's just go. Get on the fucking motorcycle. We'll keep the movie going. But like,
see, like,
dumps like that can be really silly and fun.
Intensely fleshed out the world of Pandora is when he makes Avatar, and you feel like James Cameron was no longer satisfied not crossing his T's and dotting his I's. I mean, there's really a feeling of like, yeah, I mean, it's sort of fun and jokey in this blockbuster context of sort of rolling your eyes and going, whatever. But I think that given how so much of it hinges on the thorny nature of traveling through time, yeah, that gives you a bit of a pass to fluff some of the other stuff. But when the time stuff itself is so bare bones, and Sarah Connor is like a very uninteresting character to me, and the other main character is a kid. I think obviously the most interesting character in this film is a Terminator who has something of a soul and developing that. But yeah, I think, you know, it just doesn't, it doesn't really do much for me in this day and age. I would much rather take something like Aliens over this, which at least has some room muscle behind it. Although I will admit to delighting, which a moment that I've seen many times, but seeing it on the big screen, feels like you're seeing it for the first time, is, you know, Arnie giving the thumbs up as he is dissolved by the vat of molten whatever.
Jeez.
Molten steel.
I'm gonna give you a pass on my disagreements with some of your opinions on the movie and ask, how was the 3D conversion? Because
how do you think the 3D? I'll let you finish.
James Cameron actually did shoot 3D footage with all these actors for the ride, the Terminator 2 3D in 1996 with, like, the full cameras and whatnot, and he helped design the experience. So he was definitely been interested in bringing Terminator to 3D, so much so they kind of overdo it in the ride with, like, the Super T-1000. Mm-hmm. But you gotta imagine that things like, I don't know, the T-1000 coming in the elevator, the truck, like we mentioned before, the like, if there's care put into the 3D, are those moments
Dave,
amplified
how do you,
by
how
it?
How do you think the 3D is?
I mean, I imagine that it's like technically good, but does it feel like a movie that is enhanced?
I was trying to imagine watching it again, a single scene that would benefit from 3D. There's not a lot of like pushing a camera or even long shots where one object would be in soft focus or something
Well, you got to imagine like dimension. The T-1000 like pushing through the bars could be cool.
Yeah,
coming
what,
up
yeah.
out of the floor could be cool.
Yeah, this was so to answer your question, this movie was not shot to be in 3D, and the moments where the 3D feels at all necessary or even really noticeable are few and far between. I mean, there's a moment when Arnold pumps the shotgun and the shotgun sort of juts out of the screen at your face, and there are other, you know, there are some bits with the hand sword that come shooting at you, but you know, you really don't even notice the 3D, and that's actually the best thing that you can say about the quality of the 3D conversion, which is incredible. I mean, James Cameron, I don't know how he does it. Maybe just throws enough money at it until it works. But it's the screen is so bright and the resolution is so high that you're actually able to forget that you're watching it in 3D because it feels so natural on your eye. I mean, it does so little to actually stress your eye, which is very untrue of most 3D experiences this day and age. So while I wouldn't say that you know, if you're a fan of this movie, you need to go see it in 3D, you certainly shouldn't be afraid of seeing it in 3D because more likely than not, you will not even notice that it's there.
I mean, if you're a fan of upconversions and the technology behind 3D, I would definitely go see this movie based on what you're saying.
Because
they're in the upconversion forums, hanging out and chatting about their favorite upconversions.
Ever since I had to sit through Clash of the Titans with the worst 3D conversion in my life.
If you think staring at an eclipse is bad, wait until you watch Clash of the Titans in 3D.
I've been interested in the technology of making this happen. And James Cameron, he's working on doing it without glasses, just by like brightness and frame rate. It's going to be crazy, guys.
I got to go back and you know, we were kind of slamming Terminator 2 a little bit. But you mentioned not really being into Sarah Connor as a character. I don't know. I think she's pretty uncommon, a type that we don't get to see in movies very often, and I like her struggle in this more than I ever have on any other watch of this movie, probably because I'm like, I turn on Terminator 2 waiting to watch the action, and this time I felt like in this 2.5 hour special edition cut that I rented off iTunes, I was kind of, as you were saying, like going from set piece to set piece and the in-between stuff. I was actually more into the in-between stuff where Sarah is dealing with being a psychopath and not being taken seriously and thinking about the future and not knowing about the future. And then like watching children play.
The Kyle Reese scene in it?
Where Kyle
appears
Michael
for
Bean her.
The Michael
scene? Yeah. I mean, that kind of stuff, like the unrequited, the love angle, and then like the parenting angle, her watching her arms dealing buddy play with his kid, and like she's dreaming, and then all of a sudden she has these horrific nightmares of the apocalypse or Judgment Day. Like,
yeah,
that stuff really kind of moves me.
There's one place where this character type is very, very common, and that's in James Cameron movies. And,
right.
You know, I just think that I don't, you know, she's an interesting enough character as is, but I think when you think of the other, particularly the female leads in James Cameron movies, I'm not going to make a case that he is, you know, the world's foremost feminist filmmaker or anything, but he has certainly made a number of strong women, at least certainly physically strong women at the very least.
But I think that's important too. Like, I know, you know, I don't want to on our broadcast here be overly talking about the way people look in movies because that's probably dangerous territory, but I can't help it here. Like, she is ripped, man. She looks crazy, incredible. Like, she's just gotten such amazing shape and she's like running around gunning people down and doing all these stunts. Like, that's really impressive. You don't see actors go that length for an action movie anymore. She looks like an action star, and it helps the movie so much.
There is no doubt about that. She absolutely looks the part. She is a badass. You would not want to fuck with her, and you believe as soon as the movie starts that anyone, almost including the T-1000, is in danger when they come near her, if she, you know, is not friendly towards them. But she's hyper capable. I mean, it's no fun character, but like all the characters except for the non-human ones in this movie, I don't know if it's her plight is necessarily enough to sustain what's going on.
You don't
here.
Think the scene where she is holding Miles Dyson, you know, hostage, or she's thinking about shooting him in the head,
I don't
and his kid is right
buy
there?
Her like commando rampage into that. And so I struggle with all that stuff. I think it's a lot more natural when she's holding the guy and the kid
but
or whatever.
She had just had the vision of Judgment Day. Like,
I know. She knows what's coming. I still just like didn't really...
I think this, if you had seen this movie in its early 90s context, it might be like slightly different, or at least closer to how I view it, because like sequels were all bad.
Yeah.
There was like James Cameron sequels, which were tolerable, and then the rest of the sequels in the world were bad because they, at that point, were just like the let's give them more of the blank.
I thought
the
about
cool thing
that.
About Terminator 2 is that it starts off thinking that you're getting more of the blank and then pivots to like pure action
to video.
In the mall.
Yeah, I thought about
pivots
that.
To video.
I thought about that constantly while I was watching it. Like, what if I saw this in the mall in Stamford, Connecticut on opening weekend on like a Saturday afternoon in the summer with a huge tub of popcorn and a whole bunch of kids outside? Like, I probably would have lost my mind. Context definitely plays a role here.
Well, you definitely would have lost your mind if you were young, because this haunts me. Ever since like Force Awakens came out and that whole Mary Sue outrage storm occurred, I can't get it out of my mind. When I'm like, we talked about it, the Dark Tower, this kid, this boy is totally a Mary Sue. It's the Last Action Hero model. This movie is kind of like Last Action Hero with less comedy, but I was waiting for Cameron to kind of like pull Edward Furlong back a little. I didn't realize he was so, I've got a big hero now. I totally forgot that he's like teaching him to smile and stuff. I'm like, oh my God, he is a Mary Sue. He's got his hero from the video games and he's living his dreams. This sucks. That's bad. But, I love when Edward Furlong is...
The point
Furlong
of the entire story is that he's the only one that can do the thing.
I know, but there's saves. Two... You can play that two ways, and the movie does both. The movie plays John Connor as being like, I've got a hero now. Punch this guy I don't like. Ha ha ha. And then you have John Connor like helping them infiltrate Skynet, which is a crazy scene. I kept thinking, like, what? You're bringing your son on this? But then again, he's going to be the leader of the resistance in the future. So, yeah, you get to break into Skynet and hack the system and, like, duct tape a guard at the front of the building. Like, yeah, you're in this. And that's when he's, like, part of the team. And that's when the movie plays him the right way, I think.
I think the art of this type of schlock, which James Cameron's really good at early on in his career, is it gives you just enough of the story to like get away with it that I like the plot holes that having to do with time and how it actually works and why you take your kid on this thing.
You've made diagrams. Admit it.
I have made diagrams, but the cool thing about this sort of movie is that it doesn't explicitly count anything out. Which means that if the movie can have enough momentum to get you through it, and it makes fans of these movies, the fans like fill in all that with like bullshit. But then Terminator 3 happens, and everything gets complicated.
Got to do it for
the fans. But for our brief moment of Terminator 2 is the moment where you like see it end, and giving your understanding of time travel, you're either super psyched the heroes won, or super depressed that no matter what we do, you know at the end of that road is Judgment Day. And so I think that like. It's one of the franchising action movies now that we know that's going to be like the legacy of our fucking blockbuster filmmaking lifetime that I think functions really well knowing what it without knowing that it has to be like this launching off point for other things. It's just like we need to be a good part two and then we need to execute on that level, and it is like a chase movie. But it introduced everybody to new forms of CGI and lovable Arnold Schwarzenegger instead of a terrifying Arnold Schwarzenegger, which he wrote into True Lies.
Yeah, it did.
Good old Terminator 2.
More chase movies, more movies like Terminator 2, but that are even better. More movies that look like photos. I really don't want to be a film stickler here, but Terminator 2 looks amazing. Like blues and oranges and just the absurd comic book colors of this movie on film, where you can race out into the streets of LA and it looks like a real place that you've just been to, and it looks like a photo. It really goes a long way. I keep thinking of Captain America Winter Soldier and how flat that movie looks, and people are, I know a lot of people are impressed by the like highway action scene in that movie. nothing in that compares to this because it doesn't feel textured. The what? Oh, in Captain America Winter Soldier.
Such garbage.
Winter Soldier. Oh my God.
I mean, yeah, there's no, I mean, don't get me wrong. I set a very different bar for James Cameron than I do the Marvel movies. And the worst sequence in Terminator 2 is so many times better than you know, the best sequence you'll find in most Marvel movies. But
yeah,
I think they could just look better.
Captain America Winter Soldier is such bullshit. Like, Nazis aren't going to, like, quietly, like, get inside our government
the action,
before we
Dave,
notice.
The action.
Yeah.
Jeez.
So Terminator 2, you would see it in, you did see it in theaters in 3D. You're
if
recommending
you like this
it
movie, and if you've never seen this movie, then
time.
You should see this movie in theaters. And the 3D is far from reprehensible. I don't know if there's much of an upcharge on the ticket price, so I can't speak to that. But it's definitely worth seeing.
Dun 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 dun.
Before we close this out, I should say that I also recently rewatched Terminator 2. It was my idea to talk about it, and then I bailed on my own segment. But I like this movie, and every time I go to Los Angeles and I see the LA River that's basically a dry canal, I think about Terminator 2.
You drive a Mack truck off a bridge in honor
I would,
of it.
I mean, I would love to.
Every time.
Did you know that was the only thing he changed? That he put the glass falls out of the Mack truck in the original
reappears,
cut.
Reappears, right?
He switched it up. Yeah, he switched it up for this cut.
Oh, so it's a new cut that's actually playing in 3D?
Oh, no, it's a 3D cut of Terminator 2, but that's the only thing he changed.
The only George Lucas-y thing he did to it was...
Changing the field of stars in Titanic, that kind of thing.
I was reading an interview with Cameron. He does not like the special edition that's available to rent on iTunes, the 2.5-hour version.
That's
he
the
actually
one that
prefers
I watched,
the short
too.
Version.
And when that Michael Biehn scene showed up, I was like, wait a second.
Yeah.
I was very confused. I mean, it's like a lot of special editions where all the stuff they added was cut for a reason.
Yeah, but the Abyss special edition is so much better that I think he has a good track record of that stuff.
Oh, I don't know.
Is there a Titanic special edition?
Segment bleed, segment bleed.
Right, yeah, let's wrap up.
We'll just have to talk about Terminator 2 in a whole other segment next week just for me. Just kidding. But that does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. I look forward to hearing the rest of the episode that I missed when this episode comes out. And we'll be back talking to you next week. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And we have a website, FightingInTheWarRoom.com, where you can listen to the episodes. You can share them with your friends and family who deserve to listen to this podcast. If they're right. When they're not watching the eclipse. And you can leave your thoughts on Terminator 2 in the comments. We read them, and maybe we'll even read some stuff on the podcast. Right.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find me on IndieWire at IndieWire. You can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room. Facebook. It's what's for dinner.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You could read there all my excellent content about the Game of Thrones this week. A lot of big things happened, and I nitpick up to geekery as per usual. And you go to our website, FightingTheWarRoom.com, which we previously mentioned, and search for the Star Wars specials, which came up organically this week. But
Leia
really
organic
fun episodes. Oh, hey. But those are really fun episodes to revisit. So I would do that if I were you. If you got the bug for revisiting after last week's Quarter Quill, that's...
Didn't we spend most of that segment, like, trying to guess what was going to happen in The Force Awakens?
Oh, no. We had, let's see, there are 5 Star Wars specials, and they all cover a variety of topics.
I believe you were on one of them.
I think I was on one of them, but I was shrouded in secrecy then.
Oh, yeah,
that's right. You couldn't know anything.
I'm Katie Rich. I didn't look directly at the eclipse, so my eyes still work, so you can still find me at vanityfair.com, where I'll catch up on what everyone on the internet said about the eclipse. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich, and we're all on Twitter at FITWR, and I don't know what the lightning round question is. Can someone else tell me?
In honor of the eclipse, what is your favorite pop culture involving an eclipse not of the heart?
Fair enough. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.